Russia has acknowledged more dead in Makiivka.
The deadly Ukrainian missile strike killed 89 servicemen.
Plus, a look at the business relationship between Russia and Iran.
And the information that's coming suggests an ever-growing dependence by Russia on these Iranian products, not just loitering munitions, but also long-range missiles.
And later in the program, what message is President Volodymyr Zelensky's choice of wardrobe saying about his leadership and his intentions? Today is Wednesday, January 4th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. Russia's defense ministry said on Wednesday the death toll from Ukraine's attack on Russian soldiers in Makiivka has risen from 63 to 89, including the commander of the unit. Russian officials added that the main reason for the attack was unauthorized use of mobile phones that allowed Ukrainian forces to zero in on their location. Reuters' Olivia Chan reports.
Russia's defense ministry said on Wednesday that a deadly Ukrainian missile strike killed 89 servicemen, raising the reported death toll from 63. Lieutenant General Sergei Savryukov blamed mobile use by its soldiers for the incident.
At the present time, a commission is working to investigate the circumstances of the incident, but it is already obvious that the main reason for what happened was the switching on and mass use by personnel, contrary to the ban in place, of mobile phones in a strike zone accessible to enemy weapons. This factor allowed the enemy to track and determine the coordinates of the soldiers' location for a missile strike.
The New Year's Eve strike in Makiivka is the deadliest single incident Moscow has acknowledged since the start of the war. The defense ministry said four Ukrainian rockets hit a temporary Russian barracks in a vocational college in the Russian-occupied Donetsk region in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine initially said hundreds of Russians were killed. It has since avoided giving details. The attack has angered pro-war Russian commentators, who are increasingly vocal about what they see as a half-hearted and incompetent campaign in Ukraine. Criticism has been directed at military commanders rather than Russian President Vladimir Putin. He has not commented publicly on the attack, which has dealt a further blow after major battlefield retreats in recent months. Russia has effectively shut down all direct opposition to the war, with open criticism banned by severe media rules. But it has given comparatively free rein to pro-war nationalist bloggers, many with hundreds of thousands of followers on social media. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who rarely comments on specific Ukrainian military strikes, made no mention of the attack in a video address on Tuesday. He instead said Russia was set to launch a major offensive. Kyiv has been saying for weeks that Russia plans to order another mass conscription drive. In the latest sign that the Kremlin may be considering such a move, a little-known group claiming to represent widows of Russian soldiers released a call for Putin to order a large-scale mobilization of millions of men. Putin said last month that there was no need for an additional mobilization after he ordered what he cast as a partial mobilization on September 21st.
That's Reuters' Olivia Chan reporting. It's worth noting that blaming the attack on the use of mobile phones by troops is seen by some Western observers and journalists as a way of shifting blame away from the decisions of commanders. In fact, VOA's Kyiv reporter Anna Chernikova said on this program on Tuesday that Ukrainian intelligence teams had been following the Russian troops for weeks. As we've heard here before, Russia's use of drones has been relentless, including three consecutive nights of drone attacks on Kyiv over the New Year's holiday. Amid international sanctions, Russia has been increasingly dependent on Iran for supplying them with drones to be used to attack Ukraine. My colleague, host of Flashpoint Iran, Michael Lippin, took a closer look at the business relationship built around drone technology between Russia and Iran.
The Biden administration says it's looking at ways to target Iran's production of attack drones that it says Tehran has been providing to Moscow for ongoing Russian strikes on civilian sites in Ukraine. National Security Council spokesperson Adrienne Watson told the New York Times last week that the U.S. is seeking to restrict Iran's access to drone technologies by imposing sanctions and export controls and talking to private companies whose parts Iran already has built into drones. Sam Bendett is a Russia military analyst at the Center for a New American Security in Washington. While Russia denies using Iranian drones, Bendett told me in a phone call that evidence from Ukraine indicates otherwise.
The drones that are used to attack Ukrainian targets, Ukrainian civilian energy infrastructure, are in fact Iranian-made Shahed 136 and 131 drones. They are identical to the Iranian-made products, with a Russian label on it, which suggests that Russians are either putting them together or just simply putting a Russian name over the Iranian technology. There's a lot of data and a lot of information available from the U.S. intelligence community, which is made public, about these plans, about these acquisitions, and about these intentions. And a lot of that information is coming from, again, United States, is coming from Ukraine as well. And the information that's coming suggests an ever-growing dependence by Russia on these Iranian products, not just loitering munitions, but also long-range missiles.
Why do you think Russia wants missiles from Iran in addition to drones?
Well, it needs to bolster its own stockpiles. It's clear that Russia has used a lot at this point. It's not running out per se, but it may have gone through a significant share of its long-range missiles and wants to supplement their own stockpile with additional technology from Iran. When it comes to these Shahed 136 and 131 drones, Russia doesn't have anything like that in its arsenal. It has its own loitering munitions with a very short range of around 40 kilometers. It has very few combat unmanned aerial vehicles that it's used very sparingly, with a range of around 250 kilometers. Everything else that Russia has is used mostly for gathering intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, up to about 120 or so kilometers or less. And so Iran actually fills a very important technological gap in a Russian drone fleet. It gives Russia the ability to strike Ukrainian targets at a distance of up to 200 kilometers. The drones that Iran is selling to Russia or transferring are actually very cheap. The initially discussed costs are around $20,000 per drone, meaning each of the Shaheds may be even cheaper than some of the smaller and cheaper short-range air defense systems that Ukraine is using. So when it comes to doing cost-benefit analysis, Russia wins with regards to simply flying a large number of these drones at Ukrainian targets, overwhelming Ukrainian airspace, forcing Ukrainians to expand air defense ammunition, and eventually one of these drones actually penetrates the target to strike a stationary element like an energy power plant in Ukraine. And so this is a very important element in Russia's war in Ukraine today, and will probably persist as an important element going well into 2023.
What do we know about how Russia is sort of paying Iran back for all of these acquisitions? What is Iran actually getting in return?
Well, Iran and Russia have had a military technical relationship going back decades. Iran may be getting more sophisticated military equipment from Russia. There's talk of sophisticated aircraft and other elements and components. Russian and Iranian bilateral relationship was defined by their common opposition to U.S. goals and principles worldwide, not just in the Middle East, but in Eurasia and other parts of the world. So these two countries are sort of coming together as targets of opportunity at this point, because both see themselves on the same side of the fence with respect to U.S. and Western interests and Western pressure as defined by Moscow and Tehran.
What are the options for the U.S. and its European allies to try to constrain this growing cooperation between Iran and Russia?
Well, I'm not an expert on sanctions per se, and I'm not an expert on Iran specifically, because a lot of future U.S. actions will depend on the ones already taken against Iran. But this relationship between Moscow and Tehran offers a very interesting lesson for the global community. When two countries which find themselves on the same side of the fence when it comes to countering Western and American interests come together to share their common experience and to share how to navigate this new environment, how to avoid the sanctions altogether. And again, I think in many ways, Iran has a lot to offer Russia, but Russia probably has a lot to offer Iran also, like cash payments, like examples of captured equipment, and the prospect of long-term relationship where Iran can keep getting payments and other ways of payment for its cooperation and transfer of technology to Russia.
Well, Sam Bendett, adjunct senior fellow for the Center for a New American Security, speaking to us from the Washington, D.C. area. Thank you so much for giving us that analysis.
Thank you.
A look at President Zelensky's wardrobe in a few moments. First, though, even as Russia has acknowledged more deaths in the Makiivka attack, it's still far from the hundreds dead claimed by Ukraine. With Kyiv's reaction to the latest statements from Russia, we turn to our reporter in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova.
Surprisingly, Russian Federation is actually confirming more casualties because, as according to Ukrainian officials, the number of victims are hundreds, around 400. So, and also, it's very interesting that Russian Federation naming the main reason of this attack the use of cell phones. But again, it might be also the case. We cannot say what is definite. That Ukrainians were, and Ukrainian intelligence particularly, and Ukrainian military locating in this east part of the front line, they definitely were tracking. They were, not only phones, but in general, the activities, the movements of Russian forces. I think that it was more, you know, complex preparation for this attack, not only cell phones, but again, we will see what Russian side would say next.
And speaking of intelligence, Anna, I understand the Ukrainian spy chief is making some predictions for 2023. Can you tell us about that, please? What did he say?
Yeah, in his recent interview, the Ukrainian spy chief, Mr. Budanov, who is actually has birthday today, he mentioned to ABC News journalists that 2023, he sees 2023 as a victory year for Ukraine, and victory under his understanding is coming back to 1991 border lines. So this would include Crimea and Donbas back under Ukrainian control. And he is also saying that in the spring, we should all expect and wait for some new counter-offensive operations by the Ukrainian forces. Of course, we don't know for sure if this information is, you know, precise, because it's not for sure that spy chief would actually tell about specific plans. But according to him, spring should be very interesting period and should be very active in terms of battles and counter-offensive actions by the Ukrainian forces. So let's wait and see what's coming.
Donbas and Crimea, it's a bold prediction. What do you think?
Well, this is something that President Zelensky also saying all the time. And this is something that Ukrainian society wants, and well, it's not going to be easy, this is for sure. However, Mr. Budanov is one of those who were saying that Crimea will be back after this war, so under Ukrainian control. Maybe he has some, you know, more reasons to make this announcement. We'll see.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Mariupol Unlost Hope is a documentary focusing on the war in Ukraine. It premiered in New York in November and shows the war through the eyes of ordinary people who managed to survive. Nina Vishneva has the story, narrated for us today by Anna Rice.
Невероятно красивый город у моря. А потом братья пришли.
Mariupol residents recall what the start of Russia's invasion felt like, their words capturing the reality of war. The documentary called Mariupol Unlost Hope premiered in the US in early November in New York City. One person featured in the film is medical doctor and volunteer Jillian Zeldin, who worked for 3 months at refugee help centers at the Ukrainian-Polish border. She also taught members of the Ukrainian military how to help those wounded in a tactical operation.
I just didn't want to stand by. And so I went and found a place to be and saw many patients. I worked under the auspices of the two Israeli physicians groups that were serving there.
Roman Gorodinsky helped defend Mariupol. He lost an arm and a leg in Mariupol and was captured by the Russians. Gorodinsky says he was tortured and freed in a prisoner exchange. Now he's going through rehabilitation in the U.S.
I hope to be walking normally soon, and for my arm and leg to be working normally as well. Then I think I will join Ukraine's armed forces again.
The documentary is based on the notes of Mariupol journalist Nadezhda Sukharukova and the diaries of Mariupol residents who lived through the first month of Russian occupation. The film, produced by the Organization of Ukrainian Producers, spotlights the truth amid all the Russian disinformation, says the film's director, Max Litvinov.
The narrative that they're trying to push into Europe about how this war is just and how they have their reasons, we just knew we needed to show the truth that would stand up against all those lies.
Ukrainians in the documentary said the world must know and remember what happened in Mariupol.
It was important for us to let civilians to be heard. The voices of my mom and my grandma and dozens of thousands of people who survived the tragic war.
Ukrainian officials say the film also shows proof of Russian war crimes.
I'm sure this documentary will be used during a criminal trial in The Hague. I'll do everything to make it happen.
Tell the truth about my city. This note by journalist Nadezhda Sukharukova concludes the documentary and sums up the hopes of Ukrainian survivors. For Nina Vishneva in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
If the clothes really do make the man, what then do we make of President Zelensky's now famous military casual outfit? I spoke with Inev Rabinovich Fox of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, about her recent essay in the Washington Post. She writes about the intersection of fashion, culture, politics, and power. We started the conversation with a look at Zelensky's trip to Washington and his address to Congress last month.
He was not wearing a suit, which is the conventional attire that usually state leaders are when they're giving a formal speech to a joint session of Congress. They usually wear a suit and a tie. But Zelensky doesn't do that. That becomes his, his latest brand. He's either with his kind of like olive green T-shirt or his sweater that is kind of like giving those military vibes. He is not being seen, I think, in a suit since maybe he became president.
Let's discuss that. Why wouldn't he wear a suit?
He's a very good, his background, is in television and theater. He's a comedian. He's an actor. He really understands media and kind of like how to present himself. And I think he is building his brand. Like, he doesn't have a military background. So he cannot
position himself as like this great military leader, but he does position himself like, look, I'm like you. I'm like in the trenches, like everybody else in Ukraine.
We're sort of used to seeing leaders in military uniforms, right? We've seen Castro, Idi Amin, Stalin, Mussolini. I mean, a number of people we would think of as bad guys tend to wear military uniforms all the time. How come there haven't been any, I mean, and plenty of American presidents have had military experience, if not, you know, leadership roles. Why don't we see American presidents and American leaders wearing military uniforms?
Because I, as you said, I think we do have the tendency to associate military attire with dictatorship.
Why? See, right? That's what I want to get at is why do we do that?
Why? Because historically, right, dictators, right, or authoritarian leaders do use the army as their source of legitimacy.
So then why would Zelensky choose to wear military clothes if that's the image it portrays?
Right. I mean, and I think that's what's new with what Zelensky does, because in democracy, it is really a problematic thing to take or to use military garb as a source of power, right? Because and American leaders are actually very good and kind of like making that distinction that even though the president is the commander in chief, he will always be in a suit, right? Because his power is coming from the people and not the military. But Zelensky, right, he's in kind of like this problematic position that he's a civilian leader, but his country is in a war. So he positions himself, and again, he's not positions himself as a general. He's not wearing official uniform. He positioned himself as, right, one of the people. And because Ukraine is in a war, and all Ukrainian civilians, in a way, are becoming, you know, warriors, right, or defending their country, the military garb allows him to say that in a way that, and I think that he kind of like, right, he makes sure not to be in a uniform or in a fatigue that will make those associations to Castro and to kind of like other problematic leaders. He's wearing a military, you know, influenced attire, but not really official uniform.
I think you call it military casual in the article.
Yeah, something like that. Yes.
Well, is it working? Is his message being conveyed the way you believe he wants it to be?
I mean, I do think it works. Yes, I do. And I think he managed to really made kind of like, right, a civilian take on the military garb in a way that it is a way to kind of like still be a democratic leader that kind of like takes his legitimacy from the people and from and kind of like defends democracy, right, but with his military-inspired or military-casual attire in a way that other leaders, right, has to kind of, like, do it with a suit.
That's Inev Rabinovich-Fox of Case Western Reserve University. And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.